Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig. And we are building on AWS since 2009. And here in the podcast, you can follow along as we develop products like BucketEV, Marbot, HyperEnv, and you can learn from our practice. This is episode number 86, and we are recording this on February the 13th in 2024. In case you're watching this live on YouTube or LinkedIn, feel free to ask your questions, and we will answer them directly or at the end of the show. All right, Andreas. Today is actually a very special day in Germany where we live, Andreas, because it is a special time of the year where people kind of celebrate. It's called Fasching, so it's Carnival. If you are not living in Germany, you might know it from pictures of Cologne, where it really is crazy. So all the kids, for example, today are dressing as, for example, my son is dressed as a bee. So they are all kind of have a lot of fun today. So this is kind of a special day in Germany today. We are recording a new episode, Andreas, and let's just dive into our topics. All right?
Absolutely. Yes, Michael. The first thing is we had something else to celebrate as well. So our company called Wittig is celebrating its 9th anniversary, and so do we, obviously, because we are a 2-person company. So because of that, first of all, I think we need to thank our customers, partners, and also all of you who are listening and watching to this. Thanks a lot for supporting us over the years. We did some history research about our company to find out what happened during those 9 years. Michael, do you want to talk through the history a little bit?
Yeah, and one of the projects, Andreas, that we launched at the very beginning in 2015 is the Cloudonaut blog, and it still exists. So I think that's one of our oldest projects that's still running. We also started very early on with a consulting business, also training business, and we collaborated with an AWS partner called TechRacer at the beginning. So we basically worked on projects for them. So this was kind of our starting point to get kind of new clients. And we also launched our first software as a service product, Andreas, in 2015. It was called Time Series Guru, and it was a time series database as a service. And that's one of the projects that not exist any longer. So we closed it down because it was not really used by many customers. What else did we do in 2015, Andreas? We published our first book together with Manning, Amazon Web Services in Action, and the first edition. So that's kind of what was our start into the consulting business with AWS consulting business. And also already we try to have like product as well. So after that, in 2016, we continued the consulting and training collaboration with TechRacer. So we did a lot of projects for them. And also we acquired our first customers on our own. And also in 2016, AWS launched what was called the serverless chatbot hackathon. And this is where we submitted Marbot, our monitoring chatbot for AWS. And we also won a prize. I think, I don't know, there were many, many prizes, to be honest. Yeah. but we received one of them.
That's great.
And this project is still running, Andreas, right? So Marbot is we turned that later into a product where people pay for it. At the beginning, it was free. And then we added features and stuff, and we turned it into a product, and it's still running today. We also, in 2016, started creating video courses for a platform called Pluralsight. They, in the meantime, acquired A-Cloud Guru, so it's really now a very large platform to get AWS learning content. And they also focus on the certifications, but our courses were about CloudFormation, Andreas, I think, at the beginning, right? And also some beginner courses on the AWS Management Console. And that's what we did in 2017. We created courses for A-Cloud Guru and also for O'Reilly. So we basically started with video production in those days. And also our consulting business was growing and growing and growing. We had larger and large enterprise customers in Europe, also from the US. So this was really cool because we, I mean, not many companies in Germany have clients in the United States, but we had very large customers in the United States, which was kind of exciting for us, at least. Then kind of the consulting business was growing and growing and growing in 2018. And this is where we turned Marbot into a product. So this is now a software as a service offering. And also in 2018, we published the second edition of Amazon Web Services in Action. And this is actually something that happens very rarely. So technical books most likely will not see a second or third edition, to be honest. Because, yeah, if the topic is not something that really gets traction, then it will just, the book will just disappear after the first edition. So this was really cool for us and also for our publisher. So everyone was very excited to do that. And to be honest, Andreas, it turned out to be a lot of work updating everything. And it's not, I mean, writing the first edition was actually more fun than writing the second edition. Because you have to update all the stuff, all the screenshots, all the details. You have to double check everything, like AWS changes, everything basically between a couple of years. So you have to make sure that everything is still correct, and you have to change chapters. We also added new chapters. So this was the fun part. That was 2018, Andreas. 1 year later, 2019, we launched the Cloud and Out podcast. And this is still running today, as you might know, because you might listen to it now at the moment. And also the consulting business reaches new highs in terms of turnover as well as number of clients. And we are still a two-person business, right? So this doesn't change from 2015 to now. So it's always just the two of us. We launched one of our major products today, BucketEV, in the AWS Marketplace. So this was really an open source project before, because we had customers with that need to have a malware or antivirus solution for Amazon S3. So we created an open source project. And in 2019, to be honest, what we did is we more or less submitted the same cloud automation template to the AWS Marketplace and start selling it. And there was traction for that product. And so we added features, and then it kind of diverged from the open source project. And now it's a completely different product. It was actually, when we started, I think it was written in Ruby, which is, I don't know why it was actually written in Ruby, because we are not really Ruby developers. but back in the days, I think the SQS consumer part of the Ruby library was really easy to use. So we used that. But today BucketEV is really a solid product that is used by thousands of customers, and this was where we launched it actually in 2019. We also published our first book on our own without a publisher. It was called Rapid Docker on AWS, where we kind of explain how you can easily launch Docker workloads on AWS. So this was also an experience to kind of do it all on our own. So this is the end of 2019, Andreas. I don't know if you want to continue with the next year.
Let me continue a little bit. So 2020, we thought about, so there's Marbot for Slack. Why not do it for Microsoft Teams as well? Because back then, Microsoft Teams got more and more traction. I remember it was really a pain. So I tried first, I think, Michael, I tried to move Marbot to Microsoft Teams and failed. And you did the second try and accomplished the task. I remember that because the API was so hard to understand, from what I remember, and the documentation was really hard to go through. So yeah, this was really crazy. But yeah, we launched it for Microsoft Teams. And also back then, we invested in our video production capabilities. So we had our first recording studio in your office, and I remember traveling to your to your side to record videos there. And our idea was back then to also do paid content for CloudOnNaut. So we recorded a new video every week, and we had subscribers for those videos. So this was what we tried back then, and this was our start into video production, also when we launched the YouTube channel and so on. And then 1 year later, 2021, we basically shrank our consulting business to focus on product development, so to focus on BuckyDV and Marbot. So we turned down some of our consulting clients. And also I was on parental leave for 9 months back then. So this was also a big thing that happened because, yeah, it was mostly only you for the whole year. Then 1 year later, 2022, we launched HyperN for Jenkins, a product that failed, and we've already discontinued it. But the idea was to have a solution to deploy Jenkins to your AWS account. This was the year where you have been on parental leave for 9 months. So, yeah, it was mostly only me. But we started another thing to, because we always try to turn Cloud On Out into also not only a side project, basically, but also to have it as part of our company and also contribute to the revenue. But so we tried Cloud On Out Talent. So the idea was that we collaborate with, for example, AWS consulting partners to attract talent. So this was what we did in 2022 with interview series that we had back then. And then last year, 2023, we basically closed down our whole consulting business because the software business, the solutions we sell, grew that much that we can now rely on that only. We also launched a lot of products last year. So a lot of things. BuckyDV powered by Sophos is a new product. Then we have AttachmentDV for Atlassian, so Jira and Confluence. We also launched HyperN for GitHub Actions Runner. And we published the third edition of Amazon Web Services in Action. So we have now the third edition is out. So this is really crazy that a book is around for so many years. So that's the story so far. So we're looking forward to the next 9 years, actually. And next year we have to have a big party, Michael, the 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, we have to plan that ahead a little bit.
Okay, Michael, so let's dive a little bit into AWS-related topics more. So I've been working a lot on AWS Security Hub recently. And what I find, so I stumbled upon that many times in my career as a consultant, but it's actually crazy. So if you roll out Security Hub to many accounts of an organization where many developers work on in these AWS accounts, you end up with really a large amount of findings. So say more than 1,000, maybe more than 10,000 of findings. And it's really overwhelming to look at Security Hub, and then you see the security standards, for example, the AWS Foundational Security Best Practices, they just generate findings over findings, and it's really hard to make any sense of it. And if you look into that as an engineer, you're also getting kind of the motivation is very low to start working on this huge amount of things that should be fixed. So our observation, I think this is from our consulting work, but also from our clients, for example, from BuckyDV, we really see that many customers spend a lot of energy in solving every single finding that Security Hub comes up with. And I think it's really hard because it's so many work to go through all those findings, and many of them do not really contribute to increase your security. So 2 years ago, I've written a blog post about that, Michael, so I put it into show notes. It's the security iceberg, that's what I call it. So the problem is, so the Security Hub, what it finds, the findings that it creates, this is really the basic stuff. Yeah. So you have, I don't know, a security group that allows incoming traffic from anywhere or something like that. So this is really the basics. The problem is there is much more underneath that Security Hub cannot really find in an automated way. So I don't know, IAM policies, for example, resource policies. There's many stuff that Security Hub doesn't check at all because it cannot be checked without any knowledge about the context of your application. And so I think the issue with Security Hub is if you focus too much on fixing all those findings, you don't have any time left for working on the more technical stuff, the more advanced stuff. And this is, I think, this is a risk, actually, because you're getting, have kind of a blind spot and you're focusing so much about stuff like that. And also what I think the security hub creates findings, but those findings are, you don't need to fix every finding, in my opinion, because many findings just do not apply for your workload. I can give you a few examples. For example, the AWS Foundational Security Best Practices has a finding for a code build should not run in privileged mode. So this is something you can enable for code build, and then the container that runs your build job gets privileged mode. But in my opinion, this is needed if you do Docker in Docker. So there's no other way to build a Docker container, a Docker image. So okay, this is a finding, but I cannot fix it, so I just need to live with it. Or there's another finding, DynamoDB tables should have point-in-time recovery enabled. Okay, so this is fine for many tables, but not for all. So I have a lot of DynamoDB tables that do not include any data that I need to back up. So I think it's not necessary to turn on that feature for all my workloads. Or another one, this is one I really like, it's guard duty should be enabled. So this is just use our product. So guard duty is a topic on its own, but I think, so why do I need to enable it? Why is it so important? Is it really I don't know. But here's my advice for working with Security Hub. So I would say start with only, if possible, only one of the available security standards that reduces the number of controls that are activated. And then also disable controls that are not really useful in your context. So go through the list, take the time to go through the list. So it's often hundreds of controls per standard, and disable all of them that you think are not worth to be checked and to create findings, because this saves all the engineers in your organization from going through those really huge lists. So I think this is my advice. And if you start rolling out Security Hub, this is especially important that you start slowly, so with very little amount of controls enabled, because otherwise you will just create 10,000 findings and no one will ever start fixing those things. So focus on the very important ones and then expand later. This is my advice.
Yeah, Andreas, I can only kind of agree with that. And it's really, I mean, it's a way to spend a lot of time without much impact to fix all the findings of Security Hub, to be honest. I mean, there are a couple of them who are really interesting, but I mean, my favorite control is the one that says you have to enable, for every S3 bucket, you have to enable the event bridge integration. I mean, that's, first, it's not security related. Second, it is completely useless if you're not using it. I mean, if you're not subscribing to those events with an event bridge rule, it's just wasting money. Mm-hmm. And this is really one of the rules that I think, I mean, yeah, what's the security impact here? I mean, code build project should not have privileged mode. What's the security impact?
I mean, I don't AWS know, because it's an isolated environment anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an isolated environment. Yeah. So I don't know. Point in time recovery enable of DynamoDB tables. Not so sure. And what I also really don't like is that some of the AWS services or features themselves do not comply with these rules. And one is that really annoys me is if you create a VPC in CloudFormation, it creates a default security group, and this rule by default has an ingress and egress rule that allows all the ports from the VPC, and you cannot disable it, but it will immediately be flagged by Security Hub as insecure. And I think, okay, I mean, there's of course a feature request in the public roadmap, but I mean, this is since, I don't know, many years open. And it's really, I mean, this is really kind of annoying, because those are the findings that you cannot really fix, right? I mean, AWS creates them on their own. And then it really gets frustrating to kind of work on the findings. I'm not convinced Security Hub alone is not really the the solution, I think. I think where you really can spend your time in a very efficient way is just sit down with a colleague and randomly check IAM policies. And I'm very sure you will find some where you can improve your security. And this is also the same for probably your security groups, because this is where Security Hub kind of lacks capabilities. They don't check like the content of your policies. I mean, they have some checks, but they're very, very broad, but they don't check the details. And I think here you can spend your time much better than fixing code build project environments should not have privileged mode enabled stuff, things like that. Yeah,
absolutely, Michael. Okay, so let's continue. So the next part of the show is about AW news. So this is our AW news check. So again, Michael, I'm reading you through some of the AWS news or some of the announcements that caught my attention. I just want to hear your first reaction to it. So let's see what's up to you. So the first one is Amazon GuardDuty malware protection now supports scanning EBS managed key encrypted volumes. So what's your first reaction to that?
Yeah, I'm not using it, to be honest. I'm not using GuardDuty because, I mean, every time I enable it, I get a flood of useless findings. But yeah, I mean, it sounds interesting. And I think I would try it out, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the news here is that it supports EBS with managed keys. So this is the news here. But I looked into how does it work in general again, so because I didn't know exactly. So here's how it works. So when GuardDuty detects malicious activity that indicates something is going on an EC2 instance, then it can trigger the malware scan of the instance. And you can also trigger it on demand. So that's the second option. And then how does it work? Basically, GuardDuty creates an EBS snapshot of the instance volumes. Then it shares the snapshot with the GuardDuty account, so where the GuardDuty malware scanning is happening. GuardDuty there creates a volume of the snapshot, runs the scan for malware, and then reports back the findings. So that's how the whole thing works. So the idea is, I don't know, when the EC2 instance makes a DNS requests for, I don't know, a known malware sites or something, then it starts the scan automatically. It costs $0.03 per gigabyte that it scans through. So that's the cost that's underneath. And that's how this GuardDuty feature works. Okay, Michael. So here is the next feature. Code pipeline supports additional trigger filters and new execution modes.
Yeah, I saw that, to be honest. And it basically, what I understand is, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can now, like, basically from the beginning, code pipeline was always, AWS always was telling us, okay, this is for trunk-based development, so you have one branch, and from that branch, everything happens. And I mean, since I don't know how many years, people complained that that's not how they work, because they have multiple branches, they have pull requests, and this was all not supported by Code Pipeline. And now it kind of is supported by Code Pipeline. And they call this version 2 pipelines, right?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're summarizing it correctly. So it now supports pull requests, branches you can configure when you want to run your pipeline. Yeah. That's cool. I think it's cool. It's what it was kind of missing. Others like GitHub Actions and so come with that feature. So it makes sense to implement it. And it's also interesting that Code Pipeline is back. So back in the game. So someone started developing again on Code Pipeline, which I applaud to. So,
I mean, should we, Andreas, are you proposing that we migrate everything back to Code Pipeline from GitHub?
I don't think so. No. I'm still not convinced about the user experience of all the code services, but in general, I think for those who are using it, it's a good thing. The next one is AWS Transfer Family now publishes events to Amazon Event Bridge for SFTP, FTPS, and FTP servers. So what's your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, what do you know what the content of this event is?
Yeah, so I checked it. So you get basically events about when there is a new upload or download of a file. So you get informed when... so I don't know... So you probably also know the object, so the key of the file that gets uploaded. Yeah, but in theory, this could be... So I put it on the list, Michael, because I thought this could be interesting for BuckyBaby.
Yeah, that's also what I was thinking about.
to trigger the scanning, yeah.
I mean, I find it interesting that they have... Because this is kind of what they... Like in CloudTrail, they would call this a data event, right? I mean, that could be high volume.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I haven't checked if you have to pay for it or enable it or if it's just included.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay, next one is interesting, Michael. Mm-hmm. So let's see. AWS Fargate announces a price reduction for Windows containers on Amazon ECS. So your reaction to that?
Yeah, and I think what I saw that on, to be honest, I checked all the news before. But the price reduction was kind of crazy, right? So I think that's interesting for Windows workloads. So I have no Windows workloads, but if you have Windows workloads, this is really a game changer.
Kind of, yeah. So... The text says, the announcement says, we are excited to announce that AWS Fargate for Windows containers on Amazon ECS has reduced infrastructure pricing by up to 49%. And that's true. So I checked it. So basically for the CPU and memory, so for the infrastructure, you pay half of it, 49% price reduction. But you need to keep in mind that there is also an OS license fee, of course, and this is per CPU, and this stays the same. So basically, only the infrastructure gets cheaper, which is good thing as well. So, but also the cost for the OS license is quite high compared to the infrastructure cost. So, yeah, so that's important to know. It's so funny, Michael. So then what I checked is, so if you compare the infrastructure cost for CPU and memory between Windows and Linux Fargate containers on the same CPU architecture, so it's still more expensive to run a Windows workload on Fargate, only the infrastructure for it. So the infrastructure is more expensive if you run another operating system on it. So I don't get that. because you pay for the license separately. Mm-hmm. So why is the infrastructure, the machine is more expensive if it runs Windows? So I really have no idea where this is coming from. Is it because they need more? I don't know. Maybe it's because of the virtualization that they need more overhead. I don't know. I have no idea, but that's really crazy. Yeah. Okay. So here's the last thing, Michael. Mm-hmm. Generate AWS CloudFormation templates and AWS CDK apps for existing AWS resources in minutes.
Yeah, that's a great idea, which was tried by many people before. I don't know. I mean, it sounds very good, to be honest. The question is, how well does it work? But we have to figure that out. So from my experience,
I tried it. So I tried to use that new feature, and I did a very simple test. So I had an EC2 instance running in an account, and I said, export the CloudFormation template for this EC2 instance. And what it's really cool about this new feature, it automatically detects the resources that belong, in this case, to the EC2 instance. So you say, I want to have this EC2 instance in my template, and then it says, do you also want to import those other resources that belong to it? So, for example, the subnet, the security group, the VPC, some other stuff. So in theory, I found that interesting. Of course, it doesn't cover all of it. So if you export one EC2 instance, for example, it supports the subnet of the instance and the VPC of the instance, but not the other subnets that belong to the VPC, for example. So, you can do that by manually selecting those other resources as well. And then the other thing that I found is it exports all the properties for every resource. So if you have a CloudFormation resource, it has a huge list of properties, and most of them are typically just the default values, and you don't have to specify them in your templates because you really get overwhelmed by all those attributes. So I think this is not very useful, to be honest, to have such a huge list of all the properties that you do not need to specify. And for example, when you export the EC2 instance, it includes the private IP address of the resource. And if you specify that, you basically cannot launch another instance of the template because it's already there. So it kind of helps maybe, but still I think my preferred way of creating a CloudFormation template is check the documentation, go through the required properties that I need, and then work from that. I think it's still faster to do it that way, I would assume, but maybe for those who are just starting out with CloudFormation, maybe for those, it's a helpful tool. But be careful with just copy and pasting what you get.
But what I think is the main problem here is that from my observation in accounts where stuff is created manually, first, the workloads are not isolated. So in one account, many workloads are running. And so you get a list of, I don't know, many EC2 instances, and then you have to select the right one, right? So that's the first challenge. Pick the right resources that belong together, because that's your job as a user of the feature. And the other one is that I think one of the benefits of CloudFormation is that you really, to write your CloudFormation template or your CDK app, you have to really understand how things work together, right? And this is completely missing here. And I don't think that you get very good results with that approach. But yeah, I think we can...
So partly that works. So partly it notices, so this is a reference to the other resource. And then so this is kind of a huge improvement when you compare it to their first tool, CloudFormer, back in the days. So now they, at least for some resources, that worked. So it was referencing the subnet ID, for example, with a reference reference function. But it didn't work for all of them also. So for example, the security app was just referenced by name and not hard-coded name. Yeah. So it's some progress here. So it might be useful for some, but only as a starting point. So don't expect to just export it and run the template. Yeah.
Great.
Okay, Michael. So I would say that's it. We will be back soon. Subscribe to our newsletter, podcast, and the YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. We're also looking forward to your feedback. So hello@cloudonaut.io or find us on LinkedIn or Mastodon. As always, you will find all the links in the show notes or video description. Thanks a lot for joining us. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.